Okay, let's get started. So, good morning, everybody, and welcome. So, for those of you who don't know me, I'm Jenny Lyon. I'm the current president of the Attrees Institute. So, firstly, I'd like to acknowledge and pay my respects to the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. So I'm really pleased to be here today and to welcome everybody to the first in our Climate Risk Fluency series. This is a collaboration between the Attrees Institute and the Earth Systems and Climate Change ESCC Hub. So it's a great opportunity for us to bring together scientists and business. The series is bringing together staff who work in companies' risk, financial, corporate responsibility and sustainability teams with experts in climate risk science from CSIRO, the Bureau of Meteorology and university research teams. Today, we're going to be exploring the needs of business and provide an overview of the types of information currently available about the past and future climate and the techniques available to assess future hazard extremes. There's no doubt that financial institutions are taking a growing interest in the assessment of climate-related risks. It's being encouraged by regulators, investors, directors, and they're considering their different duties and disclosure requirements. So when I was thinking about speaking to you this morning, I did a very quick Google search because I've been away. And, you know, instantly come up with comments in the press. So just a couple, an article entitled, "This is the climate risk jolt that super funds needed." So superannuation fund trustees are going to be obliged to consider climate change risk. And that's an opinion that's been put out by barristers, which have made it clear that trustees have a duty to consider climate change as a financial risk. As you'll all be aware, APRA's board member Jeff Summerhayes earlier this year described climate change as distinctly financial in nature, foreseeable, materiable and actionable now, and having potential system-wide implications. And I would say that in recent conversations with senior actuaries in organisations, it's become clear to me that they have shifted in their thinking in terms of how important it is for them to be at least aware of and thinking about climate change in their risk management and being able to demonstrate to investors and regulators that they have actually taken these issues into account and have a plan. So I hope that you'll all enjoy the seminar today and that you'll find it worthwhile and want to come back to the rest of our series, which are going, the further events in this series are going to provide a deeper dive into the current state of knowledge for specific types of hazard, including case studies which will illustrate those. So now I'd like to invite the organising committee convener Tim Andrews to chair Plenary 1. It's time for business to act on climate change. Thank you.
Thank you, Jenny. Yeah, lucky enough to be on the organising committee for this. I'm also very enthusiastic about the cooperation between the Actuaries Institute and the ESCC. And hopefully we'll have a series of seminars for you over time, as Jenny indicated. Now, in terms of the title of this session, the Climate Risk Fluency, just a bit of background to that. Some of you will know that early this year, BlackRock made a statement about their expectations of directors and their expectations that directors of certain companies or certain entities would have demonstrable fluency in how climate risk affects their business and a view about what they're going to do about that. So this demonstrable climate risk fluency is something that we have kind of taken up and run with. And look, whilst you're not all directors, you will be influencing directors, and we're certainly hoping that this series and the subsequent ones will help lift the climate risk fluency in the banking and insurance sectors. So as Jenny said, we're going to do that today by there's going to be an element of kind of practical, you know, so why are we worried about, why should we be worried about climate risk, and what are the kind of practical issues that banks and insurers, financial institutions are grappling with, and then we're going to have a break, and then we'll hear after the break from the climate scientists on how they can be helping us with those issues. So that's the format for today's session. We are hoping to have plenty of time for you guys to participate as well, so we'll be looking forward to some questions from the group. To kick us off, I'd like to introduce Emma Hurd. And Emma's hopefully going to give you an understanding of why you might want to be improving your climate risk fluency. Let me tell you a bit about Emma. So she's currently the CEO at the Investor Group on Climate Change. They are, the IGCC represents institutional investors, and I think institutional investors with something like 1.6 trillion of funds. So that sounds like a lot of money. And they have a vision of an efficient transition to a sustainable low-carbon economy. So before working at IGCC, Emma spent 15 years at Westpac, where she held a range of roles that included carbon finance and emissions trading and sustainability strategy. So she sounds like just the kind of person we need to kick us off with this first session. So please join me in welcoming Emma to the podium.
Thanks, Jenny, and thanks, Tim, for that introduction. And thanks very much to the organising committee for inviting me to come along and speak today. Looking at the program and some of the speakers that you've got coming up after me, I have to admit I was joking just before we started how it's a little bit easy for me, I just set up the challenges and then let all the experts roll in after me and try and provide all the answers and the really tricky, difficult details. So really what I want to do in my opening comments and in my sort of setting up and framing of the session that you're going to have today is just spend a little bit of time setting out the key things, the main things that you probably need to be aware and understanding what's going on in terms of the impacts of climate change for business, and in particular setting out what's changed. What's changed in the last couple of years in particular? What's changed since 190 nations came together in Paris? What's changed this year? What's actually going on in terms of all of the different pieces of the puzzle? Because I find often with climate change, you see one bit over here, you see a headline over here, you have a week of frenzied media coverage around energy policy in Australia, and then Trump comes along, and it's actually very hard to get a sense of what's the actual net state of momentum and change on the climate change debate. So I'm going to talk through a little bit about what are the macro settings that you need to be aware of, what are the changes in the regulatory shifts, and we've already heard a little bit about some of those announcements that have been made so far this year, last year, late last year. Just talk about what's going on with the role of investors and how that investor pressure is evolving and changing and what they're actually doing in a number of different ways. Talk about not just the risk side of the equation, but also the opportunity, and then finally come back to the actual impacts of climate change itself, which I think is hopefully useful for this audience and then also useful for the conversation that you're having for the rest of the morning. And I do all that in roughly 20 minutes. I do talk quite fast, so if I start getting a bit out of control and on the speed factor, then just, you know, sort of give me a little bit of a wave and I'll slow down a little bit. Or if you can't hear me again, give me a wave and I'll step back closer to the microphone because I also do tend to roam around. I'm also conscious of the fact that there are people on a webinar, so again, if I roam away from the microphone too far, feel free to just rustle around and remind me that you're there and I'll come back to the microphone. So I just want to revisit Paris, the Paris Agreement. So much is mentioned about it, but why was it so significant? What is it actually doing? What's the impact of it for financial institutions? And I think it's worth highlighting the fact that it's not even 2 years old. In December, it will be 2 years old, 2 years since it was actually agreed. And it's very easy to forget that even during the climate change talks in Paris, there was no certainty that an agreement was actually going to be reached. But at the same time, it was reached. It was ratified with unprecedented level of speed. 190 nations have signed up to it. Two exceptions. It was Syria and Nicaragua. Now it's Syria and the US in terms of ratifying the Paris Agreement. And it has already started acting as a massive investment signal. And there's a couple of reasons for this. The first is that the Paris Agreement is quite different to previous climate change agreements. It's not a legal framework. It's not a legal agreement. It doesn't set top-down universal goals. It actually is a continuous process that nations commit to by providing their own bottom-up national emission reduction commitments. So the framework that it's provided is much more realistic, much more reflective of the way that countries actually set their own policies and their commitments. It also isn't just a fixed point in time, get to a certain date, stop and renegotiate the whole thing and have another 20 years of endless fights about how to get the next agreement. It's a continuous process now. It sort of has fixed points of review where countries stop, they review, and then they have a commitment to ratchet up their commitments. So you don't go backwards, you go upwards, or you stay the same, but you don't go backwards. So this is quite important because it provides that underlying certainty of the direction of travel around national commitments. It also allows for countries themselves to set out what their plans are under the framework. So you can look at those national plans and see where the national priorities are in terms of potential investment risks and also investment opportunities. So, for example, look at the nationally determined contributions, or you know, the NDCs for UN language, across Southeast Asia, and you see two things stand out incredibly strongly: deforestation and forestry-related and ag sector investment opportunities and renewable energy. You look at the ones across Europe and it's all about decarbonisation of the energy sector and energy efficiency. You can actually see where the clusters of activity are and begin to understand the investment implications. The other thing that's really significant about Paris is that it includes numbers, numbers for the first time that are universally binding. I mean, yes, there's a blizzard of national emission reduction targets that all have complicated baselines, end dates, start dates, different formulations as everyone tries to figure out the best target for themselves. But there are two numbers that are consistent across all of them. One, limit warming to less than 2 degrees, preferably less than 1.5. And secondly, in order to achieve that, move to net zero emissions by the second half of the century. So 2 and 0 are the two numbers that you see reflected everywhere. You see them reflected in national strategies, you see them reflected in business strategies, you see them reflected in portfolio strategies, product commitments, consumer commitments. You see those two numbers reflecting in a whole variety of ways in terms of both the business and the policy response to climate change. So it's just really important to remember them. If you're talking about the science, you will have a conversation around the gross inadequacy of those numbers and the fact that they actually do imply warming of 2 degrees, which is also an element of financial risk that needs to be managed, but I'll come back to that. So Paris, only 2 years old, already a huge influence, a change in the way we think about climate change policy, and a whopping great big market signal. Of course, 1 year after the Paris Agreement was struck, there was a US election, and President Trump came to power. It's hard to believe it's only a year ago, basically. So much has happened. It's been so much fun. He has a very different position on climate change and has assiduously gone about dismantling or attempting to dismantle a lot of the US-based climate change policy responses. A couple of things. Despite the actual bells and whistles announcement in the Rose Garden around how the US was withdrawing from the Paris Agreement, they actually have not withdrawn from it yet. Secondly, it takes them roughly 4 years to withdraw from it once they commence the formal process of withdrawing from it, which they have not. I don't think it's any accident that the previous administration set the 4-year cooling off period from withdrawing from the climate change talks just before the US election, just in case. So they're not out yet. It'll take them 4 years to get out. So it's worth remembering that. It doesn't mean that they just don't engage, which it's very real possibility that they could. It also doesn't mean that they couldn't withdraw from the entire UN framework convention on climate change, but they haven't said they're going to do that yet. There's a couple of reasons for this. The interesting thing about the US position is that they don't, under the current Trump administration, is they don't really want to do anything about climate change, but they don't want to miss out on the negotiations around what's done under the Paris Agreement, just in case something happens that might be detrimental or disadvantageous to a US business. So they're kind of walking this fine line at the moment of both staying at the table but not really committing and sort of not really withdrawing. So it's an interesting kind of position. In the last few months, we've also seen some comments from the US administration around if they can negotiate a better deal, then it's not entirely out of the realms of possibility that they wouldn't stay in some form. Although I'm caveating everything I'm saying with the observation that with Trump, what he says is not what he does, and what he does is not necessarily the same from one day to the next, and it's very difficult to actually see precisely what they're doing. But where we are right now, they've said they're getting out, but they're not out, and they haven't actually formally commenced the process to get out. The other thing which is really interesting about the US is that as soon as they announced they were getting out, a whole range of subnational actors said, well, we're still going to do stuff, and we're still going to stay in. And that includes both the state governors, and also business itself is still very active in terms of doing a lot of things. And this kind of comes back to another issue which I'll touch on again in terms of sort of rethinking just how important the political and regulatory signals are right now, because we've definitely moved from an environment in which the business response to climate change was solely dependent upon the regulatory signal to one in which the regulatory signal is now being determined by the momentum of business action on climate change. And this is the US and the impact of Trump is this sort of issue in a nutshell. Of course, the other thing which is going on, which is significant, is if we move from President Trump to President Xi Jinping. And China has made no secrets about the fact that they are very active in terms of responding to climate change, even to the point where at the 19th Communist Party Congress last week, 15 minutes into his three-hour address, what a doozy that would be, talking about the forward-looking plan for the next 5 years, 15 minutes in, and people count these things in terms of prioritisation of issues, he was on to talking about the China's role in climate change, their strong position in terms of taking, and I'm quoting here, a driving seat in international cooperation to respond to climate change, and I'm quoting again, China has become an important participant, contributor and torchbearer in the global endeavour for ecological civilization. So there's certainly no indication that China plans on backing away from its response to climate change. And I'm not going to read through all of those initiatives there, but I just wanted to give you a sense of how they're acting. Because there's a lot of talk about new coal-fired power station every week, but there's actually a significant amount of change going on. And again, look at the whole picture, don't just look at the specific announcements when it comes to China, because they are very aggressively pursuing the new wave of clean energy opportunity, I think it would be fair to say. In fact, one of the quotes that often sticks in my mind is someone from the National NDRC, I always forget what the acronym stands for, one of the big politburos in China, who made the observation to me that China imported the Industrial Revolution. It was the manufacturing factory floor of the IT revolution. It intends to own the clean energy revolution, which I think was a very telling comment. And then, of course, we come back to Australia. So it's no secret that Australia has had a troubled relationship with climate change policy over a decade-long period now. But interestingly enough, in the last week, I think it would be fair to say we've seen a very significant shift. The day after Trump announced that he was intending to pull the US out of the Paris Agreement, Australia announced it was ratifying the Paris Agreement. And the current coalition Australian government doubled down and committed to the Paris Agreement. I was down in Canberra last week with the National Energy Guarantee announcement, and someone from the government said to me that there are very few things that remain true in this building, but one of them is we will not walk away from the Paris Agreement, so whatever we do has to meet our obligations under the Paris Agreement. So already you begin to see, even with the permutations of Australian politics, the continuing and enduring influence of the Paris Agreement. The actual policy that was announced last week is not terrible, and I shouldn't say that with such a note of surprise. It could work. It could provide an implicit carbon price. It could end the climate change wars. It could actually provide investment certainty. It doesn't yet, because all of that is dependent upon implementation, politics, detail, design, take-up timeframes, all those sorts of niggly details which nobody likes in a press conference when they're announcing a new policy. But it's out there as a red flag of potential resolution, which I don't think we should be too dismissive of, even if you have strong positions around the level of ambition that's implied within the policy not being adequate. The other thing that was announced at Paris, of course, at the same time as the Paris talks were going on, was the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosure, or TCFD, as we shall henceforth call it, because that's the most ungainly name of an initiative ever, so we'll just call it the TCFD. You will be hearing from a lot more detail on the TCFD. I just want to make a couple of observations around why it's so important. Essentially, what this was it set up under the Financial Stability Board Committee of the G20. The two gentlemen there, the one on the right is Mark Carney, Governor of the Bank of England, Chair of the FSB Committee, and the one on the left is Michael. Is Michael Bloomberg, who's the Chair of the industry-led task force, the TCFD, and from Bloomberg. And this task force consisted of 31 different members, basically a who's who of the business, finance, insurance, accounting firms, rating agencies, industry, coming together and pulling together a framework for calculating and reporting the financial implications of climate change. And I want to talk a little bit about this in the context of what's changed in the last 2 years, because someone said to me recently, who's a 20-year-plus veteran of climate change policy development in Australia, that these days he's not sure what will have more influence on climate change, the Paris Agreement or the TCFD. And so these two twin initiatives that are happening are incredibly important, and it's just important to bear them in mind in terms of just how significant and influential the role of effective disclosure, pricing of risk, investment decision-making is becoming in actually tackling climate change. The other thing, one of the main things it does is puts a taxonomy around the language of climate change, translating it to the financial world. it gives it common terminology, it gives it a common way of understanding it. And in particular, there's three terms that you need to remember: transition risk, physical risk, and liability risk. And you will come back to this in detail. I don't intend to go into it in too much detail. Really what I want to highlight here is the three dimensions of transition risk: policy, market, and technological disruption. I think it's really important because for so long now we've had this attitude that the need for business to respond to climate change is a function of the regulatory and the political debate. And what this shows is that actually the regulatory response is one element of what's driving the business response. But it's not the sole driver anymore. And you only have to look at the energy industry to see how that's playing out. In fact, any industry which uses energy to see how that's playing out. So you're really seeing the disruptive elements of technological change, the broader market forces influencing national policy settings, and the policy response are all playing out across different companies, in different industries, in different markets, in different regions, in different ways, but using the same language of transition risk and physical risk. Physical risk, I think, is often quite undercooked. We don't have as good a grasp as we should around the financial implications of physical risk, which is great that you're going to spend half a day talking about precisely this, by the sounds of things, because it is, you know, if reducing emissions is hard, actually responding to the impacts of climate change is even harder. So there's no shortage of work to be done there. And of course, I think the other thing that in terms of translating, and this is an excerpt from the TCFD, the other thing that it does in translating climate change into the financial world is that it comes back to the basic proposition that exposure plus management and mitigation equals financial impact. That it's actually not a binary conversation around good or bad when you're talking about the financial impact of climate change. It's about how effectively are you identifying the financial risks associated with climate change? What's your strategy for dealing with it? How are you capitalising on emerging opportunities? What's the net effect on your bottom line? Which is a different way of thinking about the issues. Yes, you come back to the moral and ethical implications, particularly for responsible investors in a lot of ways, but principally this is the foundation upon which you're having the conversation with business. So it's you know, some will choose to divest entirely, but for the most part it's about show us that you understand your risks and you're managing them. I think we've already mentioned the shift in terms of the regulatory issues. The legal opinion around the incorporation of climate change considerations into directors' duties was extremely significant. I just want to make one observation there. It's quite interesting. 10 years ago, we were having a debate around whether or not it was a contravention of fiduciary duties to be incorporating climate change into your active financial management. And in 10 years, in terms of what's changed, we're now at the point where it's a contravention of your fiduciary duties not to be managing climate change. And that is a massive shift in terms of the pressure that's placed on both financial institutions and business in terms of how they should be responding to these sorts of issues. And again, it's that language around foreseeable, material and actionable, which is consistent for both trustees and directors, and which is what's driving so many of the investor business conversations around managing climate change as well. So what are investors doing? Just my mob. What are they actually doing? They're doing lots of different things in lots of different ways. I think the number one step, understanding risk. So there's a whole plethora of tools, frameworks that have emerged around understanding the emissions intensity of your portfolio, risk mapping high risk, high carbon assets, actually understanding applying all the same sorts of processes that you apply for you know, risk identification in terms of looking at the different dimensions, stress testing your portfolio, looking at different regulatory shifts, and then going out and talking to all your investments. So that's happened. And we've definitely, a few years ago, you would have seen quite a lot of headlines around the divestment campaigns, so that the campaign pressure to get out of fossil fuels altogether. Interestingly enough, there is a segment of the market which has adopted a divestment policy. So this is either not invest in any fossil fuel-based industries on account of their climate change contribution and risk, including banks. Are included in fossil fuel linked, for example. That's the deepest green possible divestment response you can take. And then it sort of slides up the spectrum to not having exposure to fossil fuel-based industry, to the coal sector where more than 30% of a company's revenue is derived solely from thermal coal, or not investing in fossil fuel-based companies that don't have a diversification or management strategy. So there's a whole range of spectrum now around different levels of risk appetite in terms of the views around getting out of high carbon, high risk assets. on the other side of the ledger, you've also got, you can't just divest, you've got to put your money somewhere. So it's also a question of finding where do you move your money to? Who are the better performers in an industry sector? Who's managing it well if you're comparing two companies in the same industry sector? Who is less exposed to transition risk because they've got either a diversification strategy in place or they're significantly investing in new R&D or they found an alternative energy source or whatever, whatever they're doing which is more competitively positioned them. And then also, who are the new winners in the new economy? Who are the new technology providers, the new battery storage builders, the new Teslas, for lack of a better way to put it, who are coming through, who are also going to provide that game-changing next wave of technology which capitalises on all these merging trends at the same time. Engagement, so important on understanding the answers to those questions. And the engagement that we've seen is ramping up massively, some of you may have seen, and beginning to translate to shareholder resolution activity as well. BlackRock was mentioned before. I mean, they've got a very deliberate strategy, you know, where they've sort of went out 3 years ago saying, we are now looking at this as an issue, so get yourself, gird your loins, businesses that we invest in. And then year two was writing to all of them saying, tell us exactly what you're doing. Year three is, if we don't think that you have a strategy for dealing this, we're going to vote against your directors. And they did that for the first time last year, voting against Exxon. So, you know, this evolving lack of appetite for companies that are just obfuscating or not doing anything is shifting very rapidly. And that engagement, collaborative engagement, is ramping up massively, and I'll come back to it. And again, looking at their own portfolios, are they aligned with the 2 degrees future? You know, you see different sections of the investor community doing this in different ways. In the property sector, there's quite a few net zero emissions portfolios now emerging. Or you might have 2 degree aligned investment portfolios in specific asset classes. Or, you know, capitalising on emerging opportunities in a 2 degree economy. You know, you see different ways that this is expressed, but definitely taking more often than not a whole of portfolio approach in terms of managing the risk and the opportunity. So we actually went out and asked our members, what are they doing in terms of the opportunity side of the ledger earlier this year? It was really quite interesting, and I thought this audience would probably be interested in the results. Don't worry, I'm not going to kill you with charts now. But just to give you a few couple of highlights. So international markets provided more opportunity than domestic markets in terms of low carbon opportunities, possibly as a result of the regulatory discussion. Most popular asset classes were fixed income and property and real estate, where they were in Australia, which is hardly surprising if you think about the exponential growth of green bonds and the strong rating systems in place and NABERS ratings, for example, in the property sector in Australia and the clear business case. But also we saw the biggest emerging area of opportunity was listed equities. And in particular, we've now got, say, FTSE Russell and MSCI building low-carbon passive investment indices, which allow you to not have to build a bespoke model for risk screening. You can just move whole parts of your portfolio to having an exposure to a low-carbon or lower-carbon sort of a portfolio range. It's a lot easier for bigger funds to do that, and that's the area where they saw the most opportunity. And to give you a couple of examples of precisely what that looks like, and this is not with any fear or favour of any particular investor, I might add, I randomly plucked these two examples. I'm not plugging anyone's particular product. caveat. Just a couple of recent ones. So investor, you know, in terms of the green bond issuance, I think the most recent state of the climate market report found that it's up to $895 billion in climate-aligned bonds issued this year, up from $2 billion 4 years ago. And they're aiming for $1 trillion by 2020. And where it tends to be heavily targeted is in terms of property assets, and they're generally oversubscribed because there's very strong investor appetite for exposure to green assets with good returns, which is hardly unsurprising. The other one is that what I was mentioning about the listed equities, UniSuper, this is an option available for their members. It's weighted towards international markets, I might add, which is I haven't written down there, based on the MSCI Global Environmental Index. And for companies to be included in that, at least 50% of their business revenue has to come from environmentally beneficial products and services. And you can go to their website and read in excruciating detail how they've defined environmentally beneficial, because obviously that's an area of significant scrutiny. So they're not the only ones. Property sector big on bonds, banks big on green bonds with property. Also, the funds, under their own member pressure for providing environmentally aligned investment options to their members, increasingly looking at these sorts of big mainstream green funds. So the question now is, are we actually going to see the growth of more deep green differentiated product offerings, or just the greening of the entire index?
And I think both would be my answer. I mentioned before Canada Escape adaptation. The TCFD actually very helpfully differentiates in terms of physical risk, the actual impacts of climate change, into two categories to help make it more manageable in a lot of ways. So they differentiate between acute and chronic. So being the difference between increase in the volatility or extreme conditions of short, sharp occurrences, so heavy precipitation, unprecedented storms, that kind of thing, versus the sort of slow boiling frog of actual changing global average temperatures, so sea level rise or shifting precipitation patterns, making some areas not as viable as they were in terms of crop yields, for example, or increased, on average, heat conditions in particular cities requiring different requirements for resilient infrastructure. So this is an area where this is the hardest part of climate change, I think, and particularly for investors. So how do you justify the business case for investing in resilience? How do you, when it's over a somewhat unpredictable time period, and where it's not always clear who gets the benefit of the investment, let alone how you get a return out of it. So, for example, if you build a seawall, everybody benefits, but how do you make any money off it unless you charge a toll on your seawall, for example? So, I mean, there's lots of really nitty-gritty challenges in terms of getting actual private sector money into adaptation, and then how private sector and public sector actually work to protect the returns on private assets as well. So it's a very complicated area of conversation. In Australia, we haven't done a national assessment of infrastructure at risk because of the effects of climate change in a comprehensive way since 2011. And if you think about how much the climate science has evolved since then, let alone how much infrastructure has emerged since then, I still find it amazing that we haven't done that kind of comprehensive national assessment of coastal infrastructure, I should say, at risk, given more than 85% of us live in coastal areas. There have been work that's been done on disaster resilience and disaster response through the Australian Business Roundtable on Climate Change. I know that Deloitte, the Actuaries Institute, has done some work as well. But in terms of having that national view around where the hotspots are is really significant. I'm running out of time. Don't worry. I've just got one more comment to make, and that is that if you think about a lot of the challenge of climate change is that it involves an emergence of a collective increase in our understanding of how to actually identify and manage and put in place the frameworks for understanding these sorts of issues, and then it requires the individual organisational response as part of their legal, as part of their fiduciary, as part of their financial obligations to manage the risk and capitalise on the opportunities. So everything about climate change has got this weird mix of collaborating to compete when it comes to actually get the best outcomes for your organisation. And what you tend to see is the emergence of collaborative initiatives to flush out a broader response and have a bigger impact. So this is something which has been, it was soft launched in September, it's been publicly launched in December at President Macron's 2 years since the Paris Agreement summit, which I think it's no accident is called the Climate Finance Summit, because his argument is the Paris Agreement set up the regulatory framework. What's now required is to bring in the private sector capital to actually implement the Paris Agreement. So his 2 years from Paris in Paris is about climate finance. So this initiative will be launched officially, publicly, in Paris in December. And effectively what it is five investor organisations coming together, so ourselves, the Asia Investor Group, European Investor Group, the US Investor Group, and Principles for Responsible Investment, or PRI, to coming together to launch a five-year collaborative investor engagement initiative, where we will identify the top 150 biggest emitting companies in the world, and collectively target investor engagement on those companies with a view to getting them to put in place an effective corporate governance process around climate change, act on climate change, and disclose against the TCFD. And our rough back-of-the-envelope estimation is that if we get these roughly 150 companies to move, then they are responsible for around 10% of global emissions. So in 5 years, we hope to get 150 companies acting on 10% of global emissions to support the Paris Agreement. We're in the process of recruiting investors to sign up for this initiative. So the actual launch will be how many investors with how many trillion of assets under management, targeting which companies. We'll also be publishing the all-important list of companies then, and the detailed ask. around that point, and then we'll be implementing it over the next 5 years. So I think this is really significant, one, because not just because it's got a great logo, but also because it actually shows an unprecedented level of collaboration to get consistent messaging across business, to get them to put in place risk management through corporate governance, to act, to disclose on climate change. And if we didn't have the Paris Agreement, if we didn't have the TCFD, and if we didn't have those legal obligations, we wouldn't be able to ask for any of those three things. So that's how much has changed in the last 2 years since the Paris Agreement was actually formed. So I'm going to stop there because there's lots of things that we could talk about, but I just want to hit up in terms of my main points again. Paris Agreement, major market signal, carbon risk, financially material, and becoming increasingly so. Investors actively looking to minimise their exposure to high-risk, high-carbon assets and increase their exposure to emerging low-carbon investments. Either way, significant investment and activity around adaptation is required, whether you're talking about market transformation or physical impacts. And then lastly, this is a very fast-moving area. Don't be distracted by the tepid pace of the Australian policy environment. Actually look at what's going on in all markets, in all industry sectors, and keep your eye on the ball and not on some of the scuffles going on around the sidelines. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Emma. Perfect. You did leave us about 10 minutes for questions, so I'll be opening it up now to see if anyone would like to raise a question.
I'm just wondering what that meant, like why, and what that might mean for like insurers trying to manage risk in this country.
Well, yeah, I should have said public open source study. Okay. There has been a lot of work being done in developing proprietary for sale models of physical risk assessment. There are a number of models that are available which can allow you to do a revenue impact assessment on an asset basis, if you've got the dough. So I guess what I was referring to there is a sort of national, high-level, open-source, publicly available assessment of key areas of infrastructure at risk. I think that hasn't happened because, well, it's a huge piece of work. It took them a few years to do it. And it was done by the former Department of Climate Change, which was then disbanded. You know, we had a couple of years of particularly vitriolic climate change politics between 2012-2014. And then since 2014, we've had that slow, steady creep back forward again. It's like 5 steps back, and now we've kind of 6 steps forward. So we had to go backwards and move forward again. I think as well, just people were focused on getting, if you think about the timing of that, they were very focused on getting the mitigation or the emission reduction framework in place. And now that you've sort of got an understanding of what's going on there, a lot of people are turning their focus back to the other side of the ledger in terms of, even if we do our best work, we're still going to have at least 1.5, probably more than 2 degrees of warming. And what does that actually mean? But you've got some parameters around which you can assess it now. So I guess I'm differentiating, to answer your question, I'm differentiating between the public and the private sector developed for commercial purpose use.
Emma, I imagine that you would meet with a lot of the companies that your institutions are investing in. So I suppose I'm interested to know how do you find that they're responding to, I suppose, your expectations and also the TCFD recommendations. What's the response you're seeing?
Mind if I sit down? Can you guys see me, or would you rather I stand up? I mean, I think we've had 2 waves. It's almost like the general rule of thumb that I sort of say is that after the Paris Agreement was finalised, there was like an 18-month lag period. And if you think about the way that companies work, there was roughly 6 months of getting agreement to actually put in place a proper climate change response to the Paris Agreement, and then 12 months, a month to do it, and then 11 months to get it approved internally and start implementing it, and then be prepared to publicly talk about it. I mean, that's, if we're going to be brutally honest about it, that's generally the cycle in which companies do a whole of organisation strategical shift on a major issue in a highly politicised environment. I think that's not unreasonable, perhaps speaking with my former working for a corporate hat on. But it's clearly inadequate in terms of speed, and a lot has moved around them while they were doing that work as well. Actually, I'll stand up because it feels a bit weird talking to people's feet. And you have the TCFD happening concurrently, and what you've seen is a lot of the investor corporate engagement that's been going on has been around what are you going to do around TCFD, how are you going to deal with it. And in particular, the last round of AGM seasons, you've seen a lot of pressure on companies to disclose on TCFD. Most recently, shareholder resolution at Origin's AGM, which, while unsuccessful, was again calling for TCFD disclosure. Or you may have seen the vote going on BHP around their political lobbying position and membership of the MCA, which was again based around investor discussions on TCFD. So TCFD is the Trojan horse in a lot of ways because it's just about reporting the impacts, but it's actually the vehicle for talking about what are you actually doing against those core parameters of governance and risk management and strategy. What are your metrics? How are you reporting on it? When are you going to be public about it? You know, when are you going to start doing some serious scenario analysis around impacts for your industry? So, I mean, that is sort of acting as an accelerant in terms of those company discussions. So you started with Paris, translating Paris into corporate response, and then TCFD's come around the other side and suddenly made it a whole lot more real. I guess the analogy is that pre-Paris, it was fine for companies to make qualitative statements around climate change. We accept science. We believe in preserving the environmental for future generations. Post-Paris, it's all about the quantified analysis of the financial implications for your company in your annual report. That's the shift that's happened in the last 2 years.
Hi, the Responsible Investment Association has ratings or endorsements of investment managers on ethical grounds, and their mandate's broader than climate. They look at other issues as well. But I'm just wondering, does your organisation support that initiative? Do your members use those funds? Do you see that as a useful exercise?
Yeah, we work quite closely with REA, the Responsible Investment Association of Australia. We don't, and that's more of a consumer-facing or retail-facing option. It's designed to help ordinary members of the community understand where their money is, where their super is, and what's the response of their particular fund, not just the whole of organisation, but the product that they're invested in. How green is it without having to read the entire T&Cs or product disclosure statement? We definitely support any kind of certification or rating schemes that provide easily digestible, wider dissemination and community awareness of incorporating environmental considerations into products. We don't use them per se, but a lot of my members do. I do apply them to their products and services and do see it as a very helpful contribution to the conversation they're having with their members about how they're responding to climate change.
Hi, Emma. How are you communicating with actual asset owners and their delegates who quite often are working to much shorter term timeframes and there's pressure to actually achieve a certain investment outcome, particularly where there's unfunded schemes, etc. And yet the issues that are being discussed are very long term in nature. How are you dealing with the trustees, their mindset, their obligations?
Well, I don't necessarily agree with the premise of the question that it's a long-term issue. I mean, if you're an investor in AGL, for example, you would have spent most of the year looking at climate change policy and trying to understand the implications for their balance sheet, possibly talking to their head of transition, who was appointed at the beginning of the year, or understanding how they're going to manage some of their key coal-fired generation assets as part of their transition plan under their climate change strategy. So I think, yes, there are long-term issues at play, but I don't think it's fair to argue anymore that this is not a short-term issue as well. The way that I answer the question is that in the same way that you have different strategies for managing risk on a short-term basis, you have different strategies for managing risk on a long-term basis, and the same applies to climate change. If you're thinking about the physical risks, it might not necessarily be a short-term issue if it's sea level rise. It might be if it's increasing frequency of extreme weather conditions and you've got a mine in Queensland that's underwater for half the year, for example, or a port that's not going to get half of its contracts filled because the mine that it's attached to can't get approved to be built, for example. So, I mean, the timeframes are not the same issue that the argument that we were having a few years ago. I actually think it's just a different way of actually managing it in response to the understanding the dimensions of the issue. But yeah, short-termism is an issue on every front.
Okay. You probably fit one more question in.
I think you're going to have lots of opportunity to talk about all these things in much more detail with the panels that are coming as well. But I guess I was really just trying to show how they all fit together, and happy to answer any questions. I think My email address is on the slides if anyone wants to follow up as well.
And Emma, you'll be here in the break?
I've got to duck off after this.
Okay.
Plane, sorry.
Okay, well, you won't be able to talk to Emma in the break.
Sorry.
So please join me in thanking Emma. And Emma, please.